Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and a warm welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. And today, things are going Nordic. Really Nordic. We're talking about Viking sagas, about the stories of an era that just won't let us go.
And that immediately raises the question, why is that? There are so many fascinating eras. Romans, Celts, the High Middle Ages. But when you say Vikings, everyone instantly has images in their head. Dragon ships, rugged coastlines, long voyages. And I think that's the crucial point. The Vikings had an incredible range. They weren't just active in Scandinavia. Their trade routes stretched from North America in the west all the way to Constantinople and the Abbasid Caliphate in the east. That's a span that, well, you'd be hard-pressed to find another culture that achieved that on the same scale.
And all of that within a period of roughly 270 years. Broadly speaking, from 793 to 1066. Archaeological finds keep confirming this. In Hedebü, in what is now Schleswig-Holstein, reindeer antler artifacts were analyzed and found to have originated from the far north of Scandinavia. Hundreds of kilometers of trade routes, and that was around 800, right at the beginning of the Viking Age.
And that brings me to a point that's important to me. Pop culture has shaped a pretty one-sided image. Series like Vikings or games like Assassin's Creed Valhalla mainly show the warrior aspect. Wild men with axes plundering coastlines. But that was
only part of the story. Most Vikings were farmers, traders, craftsmen, settlers. Raiding was episodic, not defining for the entire culture. And their shipbuilding technology wasn't just for plundering. It was designed for versatility. Trade, exploration, transport, and yes, also warfare, depending on the type of ship.
Absolutely, that range was enormous. Just think of the Varangian Guard in Constantinople, the trading empires along the Russian river systems, the settlement of Iceland and Greenland, and of course the expedition all the way to North America.
And what personally captivates me about this era is the fact that we even know about it at all. Because the Vikings had no written culture in the classical sense for a long time. Their stories were passed down orally, across generations. The skalds, specialized poets at the courts, memorized and recited complex verses in metrical form. This wasn't casual fireside storytelling, it was a highly structured system.
That's an interesting contrast to other cultures. The Greeks, with Homer and the epics, of course also had an oral tradition, similarly using metrical structures as memory aids. But with the Norse, it took considerably longer before everything was written down. The sagas weren't recorded until the 12th and 13th centuries in Iceland, sometimes centuries after the events they describe.
And that's what makes it so
fascinating and so challenging at the same time.
Because you never know exactly how much of the original remains and what the scribes changed. The Icelandic scholars didn't simply take dictation and transcribe. They interpreted, edited, contextualized. The Greeks and Romans had the advantage of establishing a writing tradition much earlier.
And yet, or perhaps precisely because of that, these stories have a power all their own. They blend historical facts with compelling narrative. You read the saga of Eric the Red and get both an adventure epic and an insight into the social structures of the Viking Age.
The question is always, where does the historical core end and fiction begin? And that's exactly what makes it so appealing to us today. Whether as a book, a series, or a foundation for reenactment, these stories are accessible on so many levels.
And that's what this episode is all about. We want to explore the full spectrum. How was Viking society structured? What's behind their mythology, behind Odin, Thor, and the Eddas? We look at the great sagas, especially Eric the Red and the Vinland sagas. And at the end, we'll discuss how historical novels carry this legacy forward today.
So, quite a journey through the Norse world. From social structure to Vinland, from Valhalla to modern Viking literature. There's a lot packed in here.
Then let's get started.
Let's take a look at how the society was actually structured. You always hear about Jarls, Karls and Thralls, this three-tier model. Nobles, free farmers, unfree. But you have to be careful here, because this classification comes from a very specific text, the Riksthura. It's a poem from the Edda, in which the god Rígr, that is Heimdall, visits Earth and stays with three families. And with each one, he fathers the progenitor of a social class.
And the fascinating thing is how bluntly the whole thing is told. The Thralls are described as crude and hunchbacked, the Karls as sturdy and red-haired, and the Jarls as radiant and noble. This isn't a sober description of society. It's a mythical narrative designed to give divine legitimacy to a social order.
And the poem itself was only written down in the 13th or 14th century, well after the actual Viking Age. What archaeology and other sources show is that the real society was much more fluid. In Iceland, for example, there were no Jarls in the classical sense at all. There, the Goðar served as local leaders, and the Alting as an assembly from 930 onwards. In Denmark, by contrast, it was much more centralized under Harald Bluetooth.
And the mobility between classes was...
Yes, it was much greater than the poem suggests. A successful merchant could definitely rise socially, and an impoverished Jarl could lose his status. It wasn't a caste society.
What was consistent across all regions, though, the vast majority of the population were farmers. Daily life revolved around agriculture, and that was hard, seasonal work.
In spring, ploughing was done with a wooden plough called an art, which often had an iron tip and was pulled by oxen or horses. Then barley and oats were sown. In summer, it was about tending livestock and harvesting hay for winter. Women maintained vegetable gardens with cabbage, onions, and herbs. In autumn, everything was brought in and preserved, and in winter, people repaired tools, wove, and told stories. This seasonal pattern was truly the rhythm of their entire lives.
And the farms themselves were impressive. The longhouses where families lived were typically around 20 to 30 meters long and about 6 to 8 meters wide on ordinary farms, though larger chieftains' halls could be considerably longer. An open fire burned in the center, where cooking, sleeping, and working all happened in the same space. Larger or smaller, depending on the family's wealth, of course.
Although, even on a small farm, they kept pigs, sheep, goats, and cattle. And children were involved from an early age. There was no school. Education was purely practical. Boys helped in the fields, girls in the household and garden, and everyone tended animals and gathered berries.
And now to a point that's often underestimated, the role of women. The blog post says, rather broadly, that women had many rights. That's essentially true. They could own property, run businesses, and divorce. But you have to consider regional and temporal variations. In some areas and periods, this was more pronounced than
in others. In Iceland, for example, women's legal standing was comparatively strong, partly because men were often at sea for months and someone had to run the farm. But in the more Christianized areas of Denmark in the 11th century, things looked quite different. One shouldn't romanticize it, but one shouldn't downplay it either. Compared to many contemporary cultures in Europe, women in Viking society did indeed have more agency.
At this point, before we get to shipbuilding, a quick word from us. If you're enjoying this episode and find these historical insights interesting, please leave a subscription and a review. That really helps us produce more episodes like this.
And speaking of craftsmanship, besides agriculture, the Vikings were also outstanding craftsmen. Metalworking, woodworking, and of course, shipbuilding. The longships are probably the first thing that comes to mind, and rightly so, because the
clinker build technique. The planks weren't placed flush side by side, but overlapping like roof tiles. And the wood wasn't sawn, but split along the grain to preserve the natural fiber structure. That made the planks flexible, yet incredibly strong.
The Gokstad ship is a prime example. It was nearly 23 meters long, built entirely of oak. They had a massive mast beam, carved from a single oak trunk, that distributed the enormous force of the sail across the hull. And despite these dimensions, the ships were light enough to be pulled ashore, or even transported over land.
And the shallow draft was a crucial advantage. These ships could sail on the open sea, but also navigate up rivers, a major advantage over many other ship types. In good wind, they reached top speeds of up to 40 knots. The average was more like 5 to 8, which was exceptionally fast for that time. The Sea Stallion, a modern replica from 2007, confirmed this.
And when you look at all of this together, society, agriculture, crafts, shipbuilding, only then do you understand how complex this culture really was. The longships weren't just a means of transportation. They were the link between trade and expansion, between a farm in Norway and the coasts of England or the rivers of Russia.
And none of this was accidental. It was the result of generations of knowledge and skill being passed down, from father to son, from mother to daughter. This practical learning from childhood wasn't just a survival strategy. It was cultural transmission.
And it was precisely this culture that produced one of the richest mythologies we know. The Vikings didn't just master their world practically, they also processed it through stories and tales of gods.
The Norse pantheon is remarkably multi-layered. These weren't abstract, distant deities ruling from a heavenly throne. They were right in the thick of things, fallible, emotional, sometimes even tragic.
And each had a very concrete function in people's daily lives. Odin, the Allfather, was god of wisdom and poetry. He sacrificed his eye to drink from Mimir's well and gain knowledge of the world. A wanderer, a shapeshifter, the god of rulers and skalds.
Thor, on the other hand, was much more tangible for common folk. The protector, god of thunder, defender of cosmic order against chaos. When a farmer looked out during a thunderstorm, that was Thor battling the giants with Mjölnir. And Freya? She's often reduced to love and fertility, but she was
far more powerful than that. Freya was also a war goddess and the master of Seidr, Norse magic. And here's something that's right there in the sources, but often gets overlooked.
Folkvangr.
Everyone knows Valhalla, Odin's Hall of the Slain. But in the poetic Edda, in Glimnismál, it says that Freya received half of all those fallen in battle. Snorri mentions this later too. They went to her hall, Sesrimnir, on Folkvangr, the people's field. The other half went to Odin. This is practically never mentioned when discussing Norse afterlife beliefs.
And that shows how much more complex the whole thing was than the usual picture. Valhalla, Folkvangr, and then Helheim for those who hadn't died a special death. Though with Helheim you have to be careful, because this notion of a gloomy, punishing realm of the dead...
Right, that notion is heavily coloured by Christian transmission. Pre-Christian sources describe Helheim more as a neutral place of the dead, not as punishment. The equation with hell only came through the monks who wrote down the texts in the 13th century, bringing their own worldview into it.
And then Ragnarök, the twilight of the gods. At its core, this isn't a final end. The Völuspá, one of the central poems of the Poetic Edda, does describe the downfall, the Fimbulwinter, the final battle in which Odin and Thor fall. But afterward, a new green earth rises from the sea. Balder returns, Thor's sons Modi and Magni survive. Destruction and...
renewal, a cyclical worldview, that's fundamentally different from the Christian apocalypse, which builds toward a final judgment. For the Norse, the end was always also a beginning. And that says a lot about their outlook on life in general.
If we now look at religious practice, the blots, meaning the...
sacrificial ceremonies. These were led by a Goði or Gyðja and followed a specific pattern. Prayers and invocations. Then the sacrificial animal was slaughtered, usually pigs, cattle or goats. The blood, called hlaut, was sprinkled on the altar and the participants. And then everyone...
ate and drank together. Ale or beer played the main role here. Meat was more for special occasions. The drink was blessed and then passed around the circle. First a cup in Odin's honor, then for Njörður and Freyr, then for the ancestors. By the way, the blessing with Thor's hammer isn't actually documented this way. We know that more from wedding rituals. But the communal drinking was definitely the social bond between humans and gods.
As for human sacrifice, we need to differentiate. The sources do report it. Ardam of Bremen describes a great sacrificial festival at the Temple of Uppsala, where allegedly 99 humans and animals were sacrificed. And Ibn Fadlan, an Arab traveller, describes a ship burial among the Rus that included a human sacrifice. But both sources come from outsiders with, well, their own agendas.
Adam was Christian, Ibn Fadlan Muslim. Both had reasons to depict pagan practices in particularly drastic terms. The archaeological evidence for systematic human sacrifice in the Viking Age is thin. Animal sacrifice, on the other hand, is well documented. Bone remains in sacrificial pits, meat residue in vessels like those found in the 9th century Oseberg ship.
And the transition to Christianity was remarkably undogmatic. There's this famous archaeological find, not from Hedeby this time, but from Trendgården near Riba in Denmark. A sandstone casting mould from the 10th century, used in the same workshop to produce both Thor's hammer pendants and...
Christian crosses. The same tool, both symbols, that's pure syncretism. They wore both in parallel, tried out both gods. If the Christian god also offers protection, why not? That was practical living, not a theological decision of principle.
And this stretched over centuries. In Norway, it took from the first Christian contacts in the 9th century, which came through trade and mission, until the political Christianization under Olaf Tryggvason around 995. In Sweden, even longer. The Temple of Uppsala was supposedly not finally abandoned until the late 11th century.
And the legacy lives on to this day.
Thor's hammer is one of the most recognizable symbols of Norse culture. This tension between pagan tradition and Christian overlay runs through the entire cultural history of the North.
And that's precisely what makes the written sources so illuminating, and at the same time, so challenging to read. Everything we know about Norse mythology was written down by Christian scholars. The Eddas, the sagas, these are our main sources. And we're going to take a closer look at them now.
The Eddas are the foundation for practically everything we know about Norse mythology. But you have to understand that these are actually two completely different works that go by the same name. The Poetic Edda, also called the Elder Edda, is a collection of anonymous poems. No one knows who composed them. They were passed down orally for centuries, and only written down in the 13th century in the famous Codex Regius, an Icelandic manuscript.
And then there's the Prose Edda, the Snorra Edda, and that one has a specific author. Snorri Sturluson, born in 1179 in Iceland. And he wasn't a reclusive monk sitting quietly in his scriptorium. Snorri was one of the most powerful men in Iceland. He was twice law speaker at the Alting, the highest political position there was. And at the same time, a poet, historian, and scholar.
As a child, he was sent to the court at Oddi, Iceland's intellectual centre at the time. There he learned Latin, law, and theology. He received an education that we would today call classically humanist. And with this background, he then wrote the Prose Edda, but not as a religious document, rather as a textbook for skalds. He wanted to explain to young poets the old verse forms and mythological references needed to understand skaldic poetry.
And that's the essential point to keep in mind. The Prose Edda is a literary work written by a Christian Icelander centuries after the actual Viking Age. Snorri systematized the pagan myths and placed them in a framework that his Christian surroundings could accept. The Gylfaginning, for example, the part where the myths are told, is structured as a dialogue between a Swedish king and three mysterious figures. A framing device that keeps the myths at a distance.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And the Poetic Edda has this problem in a different form. The poems themselves are older. Some likely date back to the 9th or 10th century, right in the middle of the Viking Age. The Völuspá, the prophecy of the seeress, is one of the most impressive pieces of Old Norse poetry. But here too, we only have these texts through Christian scribes. What was changed during transcription? What was left out? What was added to make it more compatible with Christian doctrine?
This becomes especially apparent with the topic of
Ragnarök. You can recognize Christian influences quite clearly there. The idea of a final twilight of the gods, followed by the resurrection of a new, better world, that's strongly reminiscent of Christian eschatology. Whether that was already present in the pre-Christian original or was added by the transmitters is still debated in scholarship today.
And Snorri's own biography reads almost like one of the sagas he edited. He was entangled in Icelandic power politics, had connections to the Norwegian king Hakon Hakonason, and travelled to his court twice. And in the end, he became a pawn between Icelandic clan conflicts and Norwegian power interests.
In September 1241, he was murdered at his estate in Reykholt by Gizur Thorvaldsson and a small group acting on behalf of the Norwegian king. His last words are said to have been, "Egi skal hugva." Do not strike. The author of the most important collection of Norse myths himself met a violent end, like a saga character.
And yet, without him, much of Norse mythology would be lost. Both Eddas together are by far our most important source. And their influence extends well beyond medieval studies. Richard Wagner drew heavily on the Edda material for his Ring of the Nibelung, The Twilight of the Gods, Brünnhilde, Siegfried, all of that goes back to the Völsunga saga and the Eddic poetry.
And then, of course, modern fantasy. Tolkien is the best.
Example! Tolkien was professor of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford and knew the Eddas in the original language. In the Dvergatal, the catalogue of dwarves from the Völuspá, about 70 dwarf names are listed. And if you read through them, you'll find Thorin, Dvalin, Fili, Kili, Gloin, Oin, Bombur, Ori, Nori, practically the entire dwarf company from The Hobbit.
And the name Gandalf also appears in the Dvergatal. Gandalfr, composed of Gandr, magic staff, and Alfr, elf, a magic elf. Tolkien borrowed the name from a dwarf in the Edda and turned it into his most famous wizard. That shows how deeply these ancient texts are rooted in modern fantasy. From Tolkien to Wagner to the Marvel films with Thor, at its core, everything goes back to these two text collections.
And that brings us to the next big question. What happens when the Eddas shift from mythology to concrete history? When gods are no longer at the center, but real people whose deeds were also recorded in sagas. The most famous of these is the saga of Eric the Red. Erik Thorvaldsson, better known as Erik the Red. That's, well, how do you best describe him? A strategist, a settler, a visionary, but also someone who attracted trouble everywhere. The man wasn't simply an adventurer, he was driven.
Born in Norway, where his father Thorvald already had to leave the country because of manslaughter. The family went to Iceland, and then in Iceland, the same pattern with Erik himself. He got into feuds, killed men, and the thing banished him for 3 years.
Out of Norway, out of Iceland, and then, instead of hiding, he sailed west. To a land that sailors had only whispered about. He explored the west coast of a vast island for 3 years, mapped fjords, found pasture land, and when he returned to Iceland, he had a plan.
And the plan was brilliant. He named the island Greenland. The saga explicitly says he chose the name deliberately, because people would be more likely to move there if the land had an inviting name.
The first documented case of marketing in Norse history. An ice-covered island, and he sells it as a green paradise. Though, to be fair, the fjords in the south did have good pasture land. It wasn't a complete lie, just extremely selectively presented.
And it worked. In 986, Erik set out with a fleet of 25 ships. The sagas report this, and estimates suggest perhaps 500 to 700 people. But only 14 ships arrived. The others turned back or were lost. And from these beginnings, a colony emerged that lasted for centuries. At its peak, probably 2,000 to 3,000 people lived in two main settlements, most in the eastern settlement in what is now southern Greenland, perhaps 500 in the smaller western settlement, about 500 kilometers to the north.
And they survived there for about 500 years. The western settlement was abandoned around 1350, the eastern settlement probably during the 15th century. Climate deterioration, isolation, the collapse of trade connections to Europe due to the Black Death, all of this played together.
But the real highlight comes next. Erik's son, Leif Erikson. He sailed from Greenland even further west and reached North America around the year 1000. In the sagas, the land is called Vinland, Wineland, because of the wild grapes they supposedly found there.
And the crucial thing is that this didn't remain mere legend, but was
archaeologically confirmed. In 1960, the Norwegian couple Helga and Anna Stine Ingstad discovered a settlement at the northern tip of Newfoundland. Longs or Meadows. 8 sod buildings. 3 dwellings, a smithy, workshops. In the smithy,
bog iron was processed, plus spindle whorls, a bronze pin, wood debris from shipbuilding. Unmistakably Norse. A UNESCO World Heritage Site since 1978. And in 2021, the settlement was even precisely dated to the year 1021, through the Miyake event, a solar storm from 993 that's detectable in tree rings.
Room for 60 to 90 people. A base camp for exploration, not a permanent colony. And this is where it gets interesting, because the settlement failed.
The sagas describe contacts and conflicts with the indigenous population, the Skrælings, as the Norse called them. The term was derogatory and probably referred to Algonquian peoples or related groups. The sagas report trade attempts, milk for furs, for example, but also armed confrontations. Thorvald Eriksson, Leif's brother, died in one such skirmish.
And this needs to be clearly framed. When we talk about Leif Erikson's voyage, it wasn't a discovery in the classical sense. People had long been living there. The indigenous population had been there for millennia. What Leif did was become one of the first Europeans to set foot on North American soil. That's remarkable enough, but...
It was certainly no uninhabited land. The settlement was abandoned after just a few years due to isolation, the lack of a supply route from Greenland, and conflicts with the Skrælings. The Vikings were simply outnumbered there.
And that's what makes the Vinland sagas so illuminating as a genre. They are simultaneously family chronicle, travel account, and adventure narrative. A historical core that's archaeologically confirmed, but embedded in legendary elements and a literary tradition that emerged centuries after the events. How much is history? How much is storytelling? That boundary is fluid.
And Erik himself is a good example of the fact that the Vikings were far more than just warriors. The man was a strategist, a settlement founder, a networker. He established a colony that lasted half a millennium. And his son dared the leap to North America, almost 500 years before Columbus.
And this legacy, this blend of historical substance and narrative power, is ultimately the material from which modern Viking novels weave their stories.
The sagas, the Eddas, Erik's story, these are the originals. And alongside them exists a growing world of modern historical novels that draw on precisely this material. But there's a fundamental difference to understand. A medieval saga tells a story in a completely different way than a modern novel. The Icelandic sagas are sober, laconic, almost documentary in tone. It says, "He struck and the other fell." No inner perspective, no psychology. The characters act, and the reader draws their own conclusions.
The modern historical novel does the exact opposite. It takes the framework, the characters, the events, and fills the gaps with emotion and inner perspective. How did Erik feel when he was banished for the second time? What went through Leif's mind when he first glimpsed an unknown coast? The saga is silent on this. The novel gives these moments an emotional depth that the medieval genre deliberately avoided. The goal is different, not to document, but to let readers experience it.
But for that to work, the historical research has to be solid. A good Viking novel needs authentic details. Clothing, weapons, ships, social structures, diet, the legal system at a thing. If an author puts their protagonist in 15th century plate armor or has them fight with a two-handed sword, then...
The book immediately loses its credibility. And the prime example of persistent clichés in Viking literature...
Horned helmets. The Jermundbu helmet, found in 1943 in Norway, 10th century, the only completely preserved Viking helmet. A simple iron construction with a rounded dome, nose guard, remnants of cheek guards. No horns, no wings, nothing decorative. There are a few more fragments from Tjele and Givninge in Denmark, for example, but again, all purely functional. And yet, every other book cover puts Vikings in horns.
That goes back to a very specific origin. In the late 19th century, the Swedish painter August Malmström illustrated Vikings with horns on their helmets, inspired by much older Bronze Age finds. But it really became popular in 1876, Bayreuth, Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, with costumes by Karl Emil Döbler. That's when the image was cemented. Pure theatrical aesthetics, no historical basis. But so memorable that it's been running through all of popular culture ever since.
Although the quality of Viking novels has improved enormously in recent decades, novels from the 60s and 70s still served up such clichés en masse because source material was barely accessible to authors. Today, writers work directly with archaeologists and historians, read the sagas in translation or in the Old Norse original. The result is novels that combine historical substance with gripping narrative, without distorting history.
And that brings us to the question of why interest in the Vikings is so great right now. It's not just because of series or games. Research has made huge strides in the last 20 years. DNA analysis, isotope studies, new dating methods. The picture is becoming ever more detailed and surprising. And the more verified knowledge there is, the better the fictional portrayals become. That fuels...
And thereby fuels the literature and interest at the same time. A cycle that reinforces itself.
If we now look back on this episode, the society, the mythology, the...
True. From the Eddas to Erik, all the way to Vinland. It shows how multifaceted this heritage really is. The Vikings didn't just leave us artifacts and archaeological sites, but a storytelling tradition that has lived on for over 1,000 years. In books, in reenactment, in games, wherever people take up these stories and carry them forward.
From the Skalds who recited their verses by the fire, to Snorri who wrote them down, to today's novelists. That's a, well, at its core, an unbroken chain of storytelling. And I still find that impressive after all these years.
And that's ultimately the reason these stories have such power. They're foreign enough to inspire wonder, and human enough for us to recognize ourselves in them.
With that in mind, thank you so much for listening. If this topic has grabbed you and you'd like to dive even deeper, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. The shop has an extensive selection of items related to the Viking Age. And on the blog at battlemerchant.com/en/blog, many more exciting topics await history enthusiasts.
And with that, we say goodbye for today. Until the next episode.
Bye.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.